Before I read the scripture, I want to make a few quick comments. The photograph on the screen behind me is a picture that I took at dawn in the Negev Desert in Israel a couple of weeks ago. It's much better on your bulletin, thanks to Lisa Snyder in the New Yorker. She took that picture and brightened it up a little bit. So I just want to point out your picture. Yours is way better than the one up there. I also wanted to let you know that the liturgy today is taken freely adapted from a set of liturgies called the Season of Creation that was developed originally in Australia and that was coming to this country. This particular Sunday was called Wilderness Sunday, and since I wanted to preach about the desert and streams in the Negev, I thought that would work well. And then the third thing I want to say is that the reading, the translation that I will be using is slightly different from the one that's printed in the bulletin because I like this translation better. So with that, let us listen for the word of God. This is Psalm 126. I'm reading from the New International Version. When the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion, we were like those who dreamed. Our mouths were filled with laughter, our tongues with songs of joy. Then it was said among the nations, the Lord has done great things for them. The Lord has done great things for us, and we are filled with joy. Restore our fortunes, Lord, like streams in the Negev. Those who sow with tears will reap with songs of joy. Those who go out weeping, carrying seed to sow, will return with songs of joy, carrying sheaves with them. This ends today's reading. I love the Psalms. We've read them in Covenant Bible study, we've read them in the Disciple study, and I just love the way the psalmist wrestles with God. Some of the psalms, the psalmist is angry, so the psalmist yells at God. Sometimes he's disappointed, he weeps. I just love them. It's basically a very intimate relationship that the psalmist has with God. And I don't know if you're aware, but the Book of Psalms, which is also called the Psalter, is our first real prayer book. The 150 psalms were written as songs, meant to be sung. And monks, the early monks, and I think some monks today still, chant or sing all 150 over the course of a week, which is why St. Augustine could quote from the psalms, right? And some of you know I'm in an interfaith family. I often attend services at synagogue on Friday night or Saturday morning where we chant the psalms in Hebrew. So that all of that gives me a lot of richness for the psalms. And if you want to know how to chant the psalms, just a little aside, PCUSA has a number of videos that actually give you some hints about how you could make this part of your own prayer practice. Bless you. Ellen Davis, in her wonderful book, Getting Involved with God, Rediscovering the Old Testament, tells us, and I'm quoting her now, the Psalms teach us that profound change always happens in the presence of God. And this psalm is really about change. It's about the Lord restoring the fortunes of Zion. Now, one interpretation of this psalm is that the Israelites who were banished from Israel in 587 when the Babylonians destroyed the temple are now coming back. And if you think about what we know about those early Israelites, the temple wasn't just a place of prayer. They believed God resided in the temple, in the center of the temple at the Holy of Holies. So to have the temple destroyed and then to be banished was an extremely painful situation for them. And so to be coming back from that exile brings them joy, and they say, we were like those who dreamed. We dreamed of coming back. But then, of course, some commentators say, no, you have that all wrong. That's not what it's about at all. The Israelites are pleading with God, please restore our fortunes. And they're longing for the day when they will have dreams and have their mouths filled with joy. My favorite commentator says this, in a strange way, it is always both. The Hebrew outlook on time is like that Greek character Janus, looking forward and looking backward. We were like those who dream. Another commentator, Methodist pastor, points out that in the time of the Israelites, when the psalm was written, God told people about the future in their dreams. So when they say, we were like those who dreamed. What they're really saying is God has shown us the future, and we see that we're back. God is promising laughter and joy in the future. And you know what? It doesn't really matter whether the dream has come true or the dream hasn't come true, because we trust in God. So if you look at the song, you'll notice the first three verses, a very short song. The first three verses are all about how the Lord transformed and changed things, right? And then the last three verses remind the community that joy is mixed with tears as sure as there's water in the Negev. Wait a minute, this is a desert. Water in the Negev. The Negev is a desert. And what's fascinating about the Negev is this is the desert where Abraham and Sarah, before he was Abraham, Abraham and Sarah, when the Pharaoh exiled them from Egypt, they went to the Negev. And when Moses sent spies to Canaan, we're learning early in Numbers, Moses sent them to explore Canaan. He told them, go through the Negev and into the mountain region. So today I want to focus on the desert, which is why we have this picture here. I'm looking for my tech.
There he is.
So I told you about this picture. And this picture was taken on the rim of an earth formation called a Maktesh Ramon. It's like a big crater. It's, if you can imagine the Grand Canyon, except instead of being deep, imagine it wide, for as far as you can see. And so, could I have the next slide, please, Ben? I realize I know where the Negev is because I had the pleasure of being there, but you may have no idea what I'm talking about, so I wanted you to see this map. And what you see here, in the Bible, in the Old Testament, when we talk about Israel and Judah, or sometimes speak about the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom, what we're really talking about is the Northern Kingdom is everything kind of north of Jerusalem, and the Southern Kingdom is everything kind of south of Jerusalem, and there's even more of the Negev than that's on here. The Negev is this huge 47,000 square mile desert, and it borders the Sinai in Egypt and Jordan. So here, this is all the Negev still down here. And Petra is an Old Testament city that still exists in Jordan. The Negev comes down even further. I had the pleasure of going to a city called Eilat, which is right, a port city, right on the Red Sea. And within 2 miles, you can see Jordan. And in 2 miles this way, you can see the Sinai. So this is the land when Moses led his people in the Exodus out of Egypt. He led them right through the Negev Desert, through Eilat, and then into the Transjordan. So when we were in Israel, we learned that the Negev has two types of climate, arid and semi-arid. And semi-arid means they get 2 inches of rain a year, which is not a lot of rain. Streams in the desert? But in March of 2014, the Daily Mail of London reported, and I'm not going to quote, the waters of the River Zin are seen gushing down a dry riverbed, much to the delights of locals, as recorded in a video on Friday. So Ben, could I have the next picture? So this is a much better, this is a professional photograph. This is what it looks like. This is before the streams in the Negev, and this is after the streams in the Negev. I don't know if you can see, this is all water. And if you do a little Google on the River Zin and the Negev, there's this great video where you see the water rushing. What happens is these 2 inches of rain mostly fall like in April and May, and they accumulate in the higher parts of the region. And then as the season goes on, they run right down through the gully, so it gets streams in the Negev. Let's just leave that time. And these streams are totally unpredictable. They were unpredictable in biblical times, and they're unpredictable now. So you have no idea. Is this going to be the year we get streams in the Negev? Is it next year? We don't know. So what's kind of interesting is we get these streams. We don't know when they're going to come. And I wondered as I traveled, how has the Negev fared over these years since biblical times? David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel, was quoted as saying, the future of Israel lies in the Negev. Now, 55% of Israel's land is this desert, and most of the people in Israel don't live here. I think obvious reasons. This is what grows in the Negev, you know? Cactus, and there's no water and everything else. But so when David Ben-Gurion said, the struggle is to make the desert bloom, what was he talking about? Well, initially, what he meant was that kibbutzim would be planted in the Negev. Now, a kibbutz comes from the Hebrew word for gathering. And a kibbutz is a collective living arrangement. The first kibbutz was opened in 1909, not in the Negev, more towards the Galilee. And people live collectively primarily on agriculture. And there's a lot of stuff that grows beautifully in Israel, not in the Negev, but in other parts of Israel. You get great dates, the tomatoes and cucumbers are spectacular. So when the idea was that the Negev would bloom and these kibbutzim would be planted in the Negev, the thought was, well, they'll be agricultural too. As you can imagine, this didn't work out too well. But rather, now I'm going to quote from our liturgy, but rather than treat this garden as a beast to be tamed, a dominion to be dominated, the kibbutzniks looked around and said, what do we have a lot of? Sun. And what don't we have a lot of? Water. Let's figure out how to use these gifts. These are all gifts that God has given us. How can we use these gifts? So we had the opportunity to stay at a number of kibbutzim. We stayed at one kibbutz called Kibbutz Keturah. It was established in the 1970s as a traditional agricultural kibbutz. At some point they realized this isn't working. And in 2008, the company Arava Power was formed. And Arava Power is a solar company. And what they realized was that the Arava Valley has, and I'm quoting that, the highest solar radiation levels in the world. So they took 20 acres, they put big solar panels on them, just as a little aside, which was very cool. One of the problems, of course, you have in the desert, as Tammy mentioned with the kids, is sand, right? So if you get a lot of sand on these solar panels, that interferes with the sun. So some high-tech company in Israel said, oh, I'll fix that. They invented a robot that basically goes across, doesn't use water, because remember, you don't have any. This little robot goes across and like vacuums the sand off these panels. And it's really very cool to see. And so, as a result, they're going to grow dates, but the main income for this kibbutz comes from these solar panels. It not only provides energy for the kibbutz, it provides 5%, and in the future it will provide something like 25% of energy for the city of Eilat. So they're using, this is a stream in the Negev, maybe it's not water, but it's a stream in the Negev. Now, so we've got that going on. And another kibbutz, and remember now we have a lot of sun, but we don't have a lot of water, and we're trying to grow things. So if you don't have a lot of water, one thing you can do is drip irrigation. I do drip irrigation in my little garden over here in Oslin. I thought, what's the big deal? Well, in the 1960s, a German inventor, ironically a German inventor, came to three different kibbutzim and said, I have this great way to do drip irrigation. And two of the kibbutzim said, hey, this is never going to work. The third one said, let's try it. They are now the largest producer, they were the first producer of drip irrigation in the world. They are now the largest producer of drip irrigation. They have outside investors. And if you don't have a lot of water, drip irrigation is the way to go. And even if you do have a lot of water, because we all know water is a scarce resource. And we also saw kibbutz Hazarim. I told you about kibbutz, I'm sorry. We also saw kibbutz on Shemer, where they have the ecological greenhouse. So again, this is in the middle of the desert, and Avital Gemmer, who's a big national hero in Israel, thought that one way to bring peace among people would be to have different groups work together on ecological projects, Jews and Arabs, religious and secular. By the way, in Israel, religious means Orthodox. If you are not Orthodox Jewish, you are not religious. The synagogue to which my family belongs is Reconstructionist, so we're not religious. So we're part of the secular, religious and secular, native Israelis and immigrants. Let's bring all these people together, primarily students, young people, and have them work on some ecological project. While we were there, we saw kids about middle school age, maybe a little older, do developing hydroponic lettuce through these plastic PVC pipes that looked like we could never get anything, and they were growing lettuce. Are these strings in the negative? I would say yes, these are strings in the negative. Restore our fortunes, Lord, like strings in the Negev. I bet the people of Flint, Michigan have prayers like this. People in Flint, Michigan, as I think you're probably aware, can't drink their water. It's full of lead. And the solution at the moment is to truck in bottled water. Obviously, this is not a permanent solution. We need a sustainable solution. Pete Seeger started the Clearwater, the Slough Clearwater, many years ago to get the Hudson clean. And you're probably aware that there have been a bunch of, quite a bit of PCBs dumped in the Hudson River near Hudson, New York. And now that we've been working on cleaning that up, now we have to remove a 110-acre facility that was used to clean that up. And in November of 2015, the EPA approved a plan to dismantle this. They need to dismantle and demobilize this PCB sediment factory that was built to take the PCBs out of the Hudson, which had been cleaned up for years. So, I ask you, what are our strings in the negative? You may not be aware, but our presbytery, Hudson River Presbytery, has started a project called Solarize HRP, Solarize Hudson River Presbytery. And the idea is, can we band together and put solar panels on churches? And some of us have been looking at our roof thinking, this might be a great place for solar panels. And there are two churches in our presbytery who have, in fact, already invested in solar power. Two different paths. One church bought the solar panels and have people kind of chipping in, this is your solar panel on the roof. And the other church decided to lease them. But either way, we are looking at solar panels. Maybe you live in a community that's looking at the same thing. Solarize Westchester is a campaign that's working to have communities band together to get a good price on solar energy. I live in the town of Newcastle, so Solarize Summers Newcastle is looking for ways for people to be able to get solar panels. Maybe that's one of our strings in the Negev. Our green team has been working on ways to make good use of the environment here, and starting early February, thanks to the work of Dave Ramaj and the Operations Commission, this building will have an energy light for free. And we'll look at how we're using energy here. So, what's your string in the Negev? What's your desert that might need some flourishing? May we all find ways to carry seeds to sow, to return with songs of joy, and to carry sheaves with us.